Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a panel discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences titled The European Union, United in Diversity. Speaking will be Manuela Bairros, Consul General of Portugal, David Barry, Consul General of Ireland, François Gauthier, Consul General of France, Konstantinos Orfanidis, Consul General of Greece, John Rankin, Consul General of the United Kingdom, Carlos Robles, Consul General of Spain, Wolfgang Vorwerk, Consul General of Germany, and Liboria Stellina, Consul General of Italy. Moderating tonight's discussion is Alan Berger, Senior Editorial Page Editor for the Boston Globe. We begin with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
We are very fortunate to have today talking to us about the European Union, about the unity in diversity, 8 consuls who are representing the member countries of the European Union and that are here in New England. And I'm going to very shortly present them. Manuela, the only woman among them is Manuela Bairros, representing Portugal. Then there's David Barry, representing Ireland, François Gauthier, France, Konstantinos Orfanides from Greece, John Rankin from the United Kingdom, Carlos Robles from Spain, Laborio Stellino, representing Italy, and Wolfgang Vorwerk from Germany. And moderating our discussion is Alan Berger, a senior editorial page writer at the Boston Globe. And now, Alan Berger. Thank you.
Thanks. Since Germany occupies the position of pro tem president for these 6 months, we'll have a statement first from Consul General Vorwerk.
Thank you. No statement, just a short introduction. We all here were children when the treaties of Rome were signed in 1957. But we all here at this table, I think throughout our professional career, were involved in European affairs. And that's why it is for us such a great experience to have been invited by you to do this panel. We celebrated the 50th birthday with 27 heads of state and government, the European Commission, the European Parliament, and it has been signed the Berlin Declaration. I think the message of this Berlin Declaration is that Europe is our common future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I can't resist this. There's a local saying that every broken clock is right twice a day. And I was wondering, former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld famously said that there's old Europe and new Europe. The context had to do with the disagreement about the American invasion of Iraq. But outside that context, is there any truth to it? And what are the attitudes in your countries about the continuing differences between the new members and the old members?
I think I represent a country which is neither nor new nor old, because we are in the middle. We were one of those in the middle of the process of expansion of the European Union. But we've been long enough already to speak a little bit. And what I would say is those things change with time. And what Mr. Rumsfeld said a few years ago at that moment was interesting and even witty and so on. But we are now see how things in Iraq are developing, and it doesn't look so witty now. So you know, My country is one of those that has changed most in the last 40 years and since we became members of the European Union. So it's not easy to know where we are going to be in a few years. And I don't think that you can play that also in the new with the new members. They are going to change, as all of us, we are going to change. And they are going to change profoundly. And I think that's the only thing I'm sure about it. Where we are going to change, I don't know. I think that the change has been for the very positive, and I think that we will be able to give a few surprises from time to time. I think that you will see a Europe that is going to change. Maybe more in that there are regions that are going to change more than others, maybe. But at the end of the day, it pervades all the countries, because the connection that now we have among ourselves is something which is difficult to see historical precedents, and we are influenced in very subtle ways that you cannot sometimes imagine. And I've seen that in my country, and I think it has happened in other Mediterranean countries, and then it's going to happen also in Central Europe. And maybe in 10 years' time, this discussion or this question will have no meaning, really.
If you look across the European Union, the number of states that are there, the vast differences between those countries in terms of size, in terms of scale, sophistication, level of development. Change is inevitable. Difference of emphasis, difference of approach are there for initially. And Carlos was talking about the change in Spain. Ireland would be a classic example of a country that has changed out of all recognition in the period since we joined the European Union. We've moved from a relatively underdeveloped country on the periphery of Europe right into the mainstream to be one of the better performing economies in Europe. Now, that has taken time. It has been our presence within the EU has been fundamental to that change, and principally the economic change. But it would be wrong to see it and to perceive these changes as purely of economic significance. Our attitudes have changed. We as a country have become more outward-looking. We were certainly very insular in our perception of the world. We have become outward-looking. We're looking beyond that. And some of the newer member states, particularly the smaller countries, are looking in some sense to our example to see what we gain from it. And I think that's the important thing. So as you look to the expanded European, there will be changes, there will be movement. There'll be movement on the economic field. There'll be also movement in terms of their political thinking and their political views. And the European is an organisation that can accommodate that. We're a traditional neutral country. It has never posed the slightest problem for us to be sitting down at a table with other members who are in, you know, military alliances, that kind of thing. This flexibility that is within the arrangement accommodates that. So the European Union is an accommodating group that can deal with that sort of diversity in a very easy way.
I wonder if I might just add to what David has just said, because you all have read the good news on the Northern Ireland peace process and the agreement which has been reached there between the main political parties to share power in Northern Ireland. The European Union has played a role in this, and has particularly played a role in developing the relationship between the United Kingdom and Ireland. We sit together in that organisation as two equal sovereign partners, sitting with now 27 other member states, so giving a broader nature to what used to be a rather close bilateral relationship. The booming Irish economy has certainly helped the UK to take more notice of Ireland, and Ireland is now our third largest export market in the whole of the world. It's also the case that the European Union, through their aid and assistance programmes, has put a lot of money into helping to develop Northern Ireland and help to develop community programmes to help to bring people together there. So the EU has played its own very significant role in helping to heal the relationships there and helping to achieve what was just brought together the other day.
In Europe, we have many, many different dimensions. We have new, old, east, western, Mediterranean, Nordic, central. We have everything in Europe. And we also have in Europe very old countries. My own country has 800s of history. 800 years of history. So I think that the problem here sometimes is when we think of a common foreign and security policy, we're talking about countries, very old countries sometimes. In fact, the history of Europe has hundreds in the thousands of years. And when there is a problem around the world with certain countries, you have different perspectives from different countries in Europe. For instance, I could say that if something is happening in Africa or in Brazil, Portugal will be very concerned about that. And probably other countries have other bilateral priorities for historical reasons. So whenever we want to build a foreign policy, sometimes we have these difficulties of countries, very old countries with very different traditions. So sometimes we have to get into the core values, the core ideas, the core priorities in Europe. And speaking about all the news, well, probably Iraq is a good example. But if you speak about Iraq, you will have different positions in the old Europe. So this is really a difficulty to have a common foreign policy. Sometimes countries have very different priorities and different approaches to get into the problems around the world.
I belong to a very old Europe, I have to say. But I believe that this distinction was completely artificial and natural. The lesson we have to take from these different positions that belong in any way to our community of shared values, and inside these values there is also diversity, as everyone clear, is the following question. Do you think that at that time the countries that decided to take a certain position, for instance to intervene, matter more than the countries that decide to take another position? So the lesson is that in the future, common position will allow Europe to matter more.
This is somewhat related. During the vote in France on the draft of a new constitution for the European Union, there was a fear summarized in the phrase about the Polish plumber who's going to take jobs of French workers. Now, there has been, since 2004, since the enlargement, a certain number of workers from the East who've come into the countries that were among the first 15, I guess. And in a couple of countries, namely Ireland and England, there's been an open door policy, and the results have been very positive. What are the attitudes of your publics toward the new workers who've come in with the enlargement?
We're in the fortunate situation over the last 3-4 years where the economy has been really expanding very rapidly, and there was actually a genuine need for more workers. We couldn't, the domestic work pool couldn't supply it. So we were in the fortunate situation with the expansion in May 2004 to be one of the three countries to say, look, we'll open our labour market to the new members immediately. And since that time, we've had a very significant, proportionately, a very significant number of workers from primarily from Eastern Europe have come to take up employment in Ireland. The experience to date has been overwhelmingly positive. We're in a situation where there were jobs. There was no question of someone pointing the finger saying, such a person is taking my job. It wasn't the issue. So it's been an extremely positive experience where it's actually fed the economic growth rate that we've had. It's been a part of contributing to it. Who knows how long we can maintain these growth rates, and that, as that kind of tapers off, maybe there'll be a different view. But at the moment, from both a public perception and principally from the employer perception, they're wildly enthusiastic about the new workers that have entered. Some would say, and not too jokingly, that they're better than what they were getting on the open market. But again, for us, at least now, we can say very, very positive experience.
If I may, it must not be forgotten also that the enlargement has opened incredible and terrific opportunities for the old European countries. France, for instance, is the first foreign investor in Romania and is the second foreign investor in Poland. So when you consider the whole aspect of the matter, you see that this side balances the other, and it's sometimes difficult to explain. Europe has probably a problem of communication within its borders and with its citizens. But generally speaking, the enlargement can be seen as a very positive aspect of the modern European construction.
The enlargement is a terrific achievement. First of all, the division of Europe has been overcome. A development nobody expected in his lifetime. Nobody of us. A miracle came true, not only the reunification of Germany, but reunification of Europe. We now have a European Europe. And enlargement is what we had since 50 years. The European Union became strong because we had enlargements. Because we had the southern enlargement, we had the enlargement, Great Britain, Denmark, the Scandinavian countries. So enlargement is part of our history. And our experience is since 50 years, and this will be true for the eastern enlargement too, to open our borders, to have a free movement of labor, services, capital. That has been the recipe to prosperity, to growth, and to stability, and to stable political situation. And you just talked about communication. In fact, for Germany, the Eastern Enlargement had about, if you take a balance sheet, we have moved with our firms to East Europe, but at the same time we had growth in our own country due to enlargement, and we estimate that approximately 80,000 jobs have been created through the enlargement. So we have gained and we have not lost. But the main thing is that we are reunited as Europe and that we are a stronger partner, not only for ourselves, but for the United States and our friends abroad. Thank you.
As you know, Portugal was a country of immigration. And once we thought about joining the European communities, there were some concerns in Europe that suddenly the Portuguese would leave Portugal and go immigrate to Europe. Traditionally, it was France, Germany, Switzerland is not part of the European Union, but it's our traditional destinations. And people were afraid that suddenly the Iberian Peninsula would be empty. What happened was the opposite. As we increased the economic and the standards of living in Portugal, we didn't have immigration anymore. We didn't have to immigrate. We have 300 Portuguese immigrating to the United States last year. So the traditional immigration to the United States stopped because economic conditions in Portugal improved. So what will happen in these countries? These people will stay in their countries once they have the possibility, the perspective of economic improvement. People will not leave their countries easily. They will leave their countries if they have to for jobs, for giving a better life to their families. So these fears of, you know, people coming in huge numbers to Germany or to France, this will not just happen. This will not just happen.
Well, to add to what my Portuguese colleague just said, Greece... before entering in the European Union, was a net exporter of immigrants. And to Europe also, not only to the United States or other countries out of Europe. This is how our large community in our partner country, Germany, was built. After joining the European Union, Greece is a net importer. And while in 1991 our census of population was 9 million, now we are 11 million, having almost 2 million of immigrants, mostly from Eastern European countries, because, well, the rate of birth does not allow Greeks to increase so much. So approximately 90% of this increase is due to immigration. These people, although at that time there were a lot of talks in Greece, a lot of people who had a lot of reservations, what will happen with immigration? We have 300,000, and then what will happen with immigration? We have 600,000, etc., etc. Nowadays, in most media you see that we started to feel proud that we got them, because we managed to integrate them without a lot of problems. And they were positive in our economy. They were trained workers. As you know, Eastern European countries, they have a very good working force. And I think that now that they enter, now that they are going to start to build their own infrastructure, this movement will stop and will come in balance. And as Francois, my French colleague, has just said, we give and we take in the European Union. So Greece now is the first investor in Bulgaria. At the same time, we have a lot of Bulgarians in Greece. Sometime I think that Bulgarians will stop because they are going to have their own infrastructure, etc., etc. So things are moving. And for what our coordinator had said about the Polish plumber, well, it's true that people always complain about something. What really counts is the result. And I believe that the story will continue to go on like this. And as it happened with the first enlargement, with Greek, Spanish, and Portuguese, will happen with our new partners in the European Union. Thank you.
Thanks to the enlargement, now Europe represents a market of quite 500 million of inhabitants, with a GDP of $13.5 trillion. That is higher than the USA. I too would like to stress, as my Portuguese and Greek colleagues, that Italy was still at the time of the accession, the foundation of the European Economic Community, a country of immigrants. And in the last 10, 15 years, we changed our skin and we became a country of net importing of immigrants. Probably for our tradition of immigration, we have always welcomed immigrants with a special sense of solidarity, human dignity, respect, etc. So I agree in saying that if it's true that we have a lot of people that are migrating inside Europe and are establishing their workplace in Italy, it is also true that Unicredito is the first banking group in Poland, and that other Italian industries are so huge and present in Romania or in Bulgaria. So it's a sort of two-way road with a net positive impact outside.
Do you think that you'll have a new constitution by 2009? And does the desire of political leaders to push forward with it contradict the will, the democratic will of the publics in your countries?
Maybe first a word as presidency. Angela Merkel, our chancellor and president, she said that the German presidency will present to the European Council on the 1st of June a roadmap. That means a proposal how to proceed. And we listened very attentively to our partners and to the problems and to the reserves, but also how to go on. And our ambition is, in fact, that we will present that we will be able in 2009, when the new when the European Parliament will be elected, that we then will be able to present a new basis of common understanding what we want. It may not be called constitution, but I think details are still going to be hammered out. But in the core issue is that we will find ways and means to strengthen our decision-making process. That's the core issue, because when we started out with 6 members, and today we had completely different conditions, and it was easier to take decisions. With 27 members, we have to adjust our decision-making process. That's a part of the issue. And that will be one challenge which we have to tackle.
We've got to find some solution to the new size of the organisation. The constitution is a tricky issue, and it's not for me to comment on the referenda in other countries. But I can say that had we had a referendum in the UK on the issue, it would have been a difficult issue in the UK as well. And whether we end up with something like the proposed constitution or something very different remains to be seen. But what we undoubtedly need is some new processes. In a very unimportant subcommittee, had the pleasure during one UK presidency of chairing us at 12 member states. That's difficult enough. At 27 member states, under the mechanisms of each country having its say and trying to reach a common agreement on every issue, it's a very cumbersome process indeed. And so we need to find some streamlined mechanisms to move forward effectively at 27. And whatever we call that, I think that's necessary. One of the difficulties, as I think we've had, is that by becoming bogged down in institutional questions, which almost any bureaucracy tends to do at certain points, we lose sight of the big issues. And, I mean, the big issue looking back over the past 50 years is, having had a Europe which had been, you know, torn asunder twice by 2 world wars, we now have a Europe 50 years later united in respect for democracy and human rights, and which will not go to war with each other again because of the interlinking of our economies and our politics. And so the question now is what Europe can achieve in the next 50 years, not in terms of constitutions or in structures, but in terms of outcomes in tackling the problems of globalisation and global warming and tackling poverty in developing countries. Those are the big questions which we have to face, and the constitutional issues are merely mechanisms to try to solve those big issues in the next 50 years.
We still ask the question why the project failed in 2 countries, 2 very important countries. And obviously there are many answers with some part of the whole truth. But the problem, I think, with the Constitution was probably a communication problem, but a divide. And the problem is that probably a document, a 300 pages document, was too heavy for a public opinion to understand what was going on. So undoubtedly there is the need for institutional changes, because we are a much bigger community at the moment. But I think the leaders in Europe reached the conclusion that there is a need to reach out to the public opinion. And I think there are some chapters that can be important for the public opinion. One of them, if we ask people what they are concerned about or are their views about the European Union, some people answer that they would like to see the European Union with a bigger voice abroad. This was the problem of having a common foreign policy. People are also concerned, and this is a huge concern for certain countries within the European Union, about the environment. So I think probably there are solutions in sight for changing the constitution, naming it with a different name, but we have to make sure that there are some concerns which are real concerns of the public opinion which are going to be dealt with by the European Union. I personally am very enthusiastic about the idea of having a European Union Minister for Foreign Affairs, Europe has to have a bigger voice in the world. When it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to environment, a social model, I think there are real concerns, and probably the project, if it's going to be successful, they have to deal with those issues.
I don't want to minimize the movement represented by the two referendums in Holland and in France. But I would like also to see the glass half filled, and remembering that the treaty has been ratified already by 18 member states that represent already the majority of the European population. And it's not the first time in the history of Europe that European people talk about democratic deficit or crisis of confidence, etc. 30 years ago, it was impossible to believe to a popular election of a European Parliament. And we were used to send national delegates to the Assembly in Brussels. And 20 years ago, talking about a common currency was quite a miracle. So I believe and I trust in the progress on the constitutional matter, because if we look back to these 50 years, I think that there is an objective success story that has now put us in confidence with miracles.
First of all, this referendum was as much a reflection on social discontent and a national crisis as a problem with Europe. And I think the social dimension and the discontent of the opinion explains many things about the no vote. So it was not at all a rejection of Europe. And if you look at the opinion polls, 72% of French people are proud of the European identity. So, you know, there is a strong consensus among French about the necessity and the crucial necessity of Europe. So it's not a problem, I think, in the future. You cannot rule and run Europe with 27 countries as you run it with six countries. I think it's evident, and I'm quite confident in the reform we are going to undertake with institutions.
I also think there's an issue here about the processes through the various member states, how they ratify these major events. In Ireland, we always have to do it by referendum. And it would be nice to believe that what you present to the electorate in a referendum is what they focus on. We had a similar experience a number of years ago where I think it was the Maastricht Treaty that was put to the Irish population, and they actually rejected it. Yes. Now, it became immediately apparent. We came from a situation where the population and the government were overwhelmingly pro-European. There was deep satisfaction with the government at the time, and what the electorate did, quite frankly, was they used that event to actually to embarrass the government and to get them to stop and think. Now, you can say that the electorate have decided, and indeed some of the cynics back home said at the time, we'll keep sending the referendum to you until you get the right answer. But, I mean, it was clear to everyone immediately with the outcome. A, the government didn't anticipate it. They were entirely complacent in how they sold it to the people. And there still is, in public perception, a lack of communication, a lack of real understanding what Europe is about. But when you're dealing with a referenda, it's impossible. You cannot keep it boxed in, and you cannot force people to stick with the issues and to deal with that only. I think there will always be some carryover. Now, as best you can expect it, there will people will remain focused on the main issues and won't be sidetracked. But we had that experience, so it does happen. And I'm not trying to explain that that's either the Dutch experience or the French experience. That was our experience. So it does happen.
I'm going to ask one more question, and then we'll take questions from you all. And this has to do with the whole matter of Turkey's accession. What I'm interested in is the different attitudes in your countries, because there are, from what I know, there are significant differences country to country in Europe on the attitude toward Turkey's wanting to become a member. Yes.
In Germany, 80% of all Turks in the European Union live and work. And that's why we are particularly exposed to that question. The German public has no consistent attitude. On one hand, there is a majority who cannot imagine that one day Turkey is part of the Union. On the other hand, there is a majority who say, yes, we expect Turkey will be a member in the European Union within 20 years. It's important to make the point that this process of negotiations, and these negotiations are going on, and as I hear, they are going very well. So this process is, of course, an open-ended and performance-based process concerning benchmarks like democracy, human rights, equal rights for women. We will not make compromises. We will stick to our standard, which we have in the European Union. But I consider it as a strategic decision of the European Union to give Turkey this opportunity to become a full member. And we had promised this perspective already in 1963. But it's an enormous strategic importance in this decision, because if Europe and if Turkey will achieve to become member, then this would be an important and powerful signal to the whole Middle East, that showing that our Western values and the values of a Muslim society are compatible, and that Turkey can be a member in this European Union. And we have made the experience that Turkey has already done a lot to adjust. There is still a lot to be done, and it's not an issue of negotiations alone. It's a process within Turkey. Turkey has to go through a process within the country and within the society. And only if Turkey will achieve that, it can become a member. It's a process of 15 years, perhaps, maybe of 20 years. But it's a process, and the perspective is clear. You can become a full member if you can meet our standards of the European Union, democracy, rule of law, human rights. These are our benchmarks, and we will not make compromises on that.
And you know, Alan, that despite our differences on Turkey, we came to an agreement. And now there is a process, maybe 12, 15-year period, but this is a common position of the European countries.
The door must remain open. The Copenhagen criteria, as Mr. Workert said, are there. They are not negotiable. They are indispensable parameters for the accession. If we exclude a priori a strategic geopolitical actor like Turkey to be part of our shared values community, I think that Europe goes against their principle. We have been always building something towards a community of shared values, not against something else. If we will be successful, if in 10, 20 years Turkey will be member because Turkey fulfilled all these criteria, it will be our way of exporting democracy.
I have no doubt that Turkey will do whatever necessary to abide by the Copenhagen criteria. Turkey asked for accession in 1963. And I do believe that Turkey, this is a long-term priority for Turkey. I'm sure Turkey will do whatever necessary to reach those benchmarks. But now, again, I think the problem is again with public opinion. And to be honest, I think we have to work, Turkey and the European Union have to work on that. I think there is a psychological aspect involving Turkey and Europe, and we have to work on that because the public opinions have to deal with a different way to look into history, into the history of Europe. It will take some time. We have time to prepare Turkey. We have time to prepare the public opinions in Europe. I think, as my colleagues have said, that it is huge, the responsibility of bringing Turkey in. It is very important strategically, but it's very important for Europe and for the model we want Europe to be. We want Europe to be an open model, and a community of values, a community of law, but for that we have to be open, and that is the strength of Europe. We cannot just say, well, you negotiate and then we will see. I think eventually Turkey will get into the European Union. It will take time. We have to prepare both sides and probably preparing a new history of Europe.
I think we'll take questions now. Yes.
My name is Emer. I'm a grad student at UMass Boston. I have one question for Mr. Rankin from UK. I'm just wondering, the United Kingdom is not a member of the Eurozone. To some authors, they argue like you are trying to override the Euro. Is that correct? And if you don't mind me, another question. If anybody could tell me something about Bosnian issue and any possibility that Bosnia could qualify for this candidacy. Thank you.
I'll start, but others will want to comment on the Euro as well. I certainly enjoy travelling in Europe as much as anybody else does, and it is a huge convenience for me to go and change my pound sterling into euros and then travel across Europe using a single currency. And I think for those states who have joined the Euro, it has been really a great success, and is one which I hope will continue. That said, the United Kingdom's decision not to join the Euro when it started off was the right decision for the United Kingdom. And that is because we are one of the large economies within the EU, and our economic cycle was at a very different stage from that of the other large economies within Europe. A different stage of growth. And in fact, our economic growth during the period of the Euro has been stronger than that of the other major economies who are the Euro states. So I think economically it's been the right decision for us. We have a number of economic tests, and when those economic tests from a UK economic interest are met, then we will have a referendum to see whether we'll join the Euro in the future. So we certainly haven't rejected it as a future possibility. But in the short term, it's been the right decision for the UK not to join. That's not to say it's not been absolutely the right decision for our partners to set up that currency.
Yes.
On the Bosnia issue, since 2003, in Thessaloniki, the European Council has clearly decided about the European perspective of the Western Balkan countries, and of course Western Balkan countries include Bosnia as well as Serbia, as the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia and Albania. I think that it's up to them to continue their cooperation that they have now with the European Union, strengthening their democratic institution, solving the particular problems that each one of them have with our aid, and we are trying to do our best in this respect. Serbia has its own problems. Bosnia has the problem of the communities to get together, to work finally as one country, and the rest, they have their own. The reality is that Europe has declared and is waiting that all the Western Balkan countries
they are eligible to become candidates and start to talk with the European Union, and as soon as they're going to fulfill the criteria, as the present candidates, Turkey and Croatia, when they're going to fulfill the criteria, they will be able to become members of the European Union. How soon? Well, I cannot say now, but I think that we are in a good way. I mean, there are a lot of progress in for all of these countries. Of course, more is needed. But what we can say for sure is that one day Bosnia will become a member of the European Union. Yes, for sure.
If I could come back on the euro question more particularly in related back to our own experience. Like many decisions about the European Union, it's not purely an economic issue. Ireland was very keen to be a member of the euro area immediately. There were very many pragmatic reasons for us to be there. We're a peripheral country. We wanted to be at the heart of Europe. It was important for us politically to be in the eurozone almost from the outset. But there was a discipline in achieving that standard. And in fact, there was a huge incentive in terms of the government's own management of the economy to bring it into line to the point where we could join the eurozone. So there's both an economic benefit to us, but also there's a political imperative there to be seen to be at the heart of Europe and not on the periphery. Now, if you're a large member state in Europe, that may not be as important to you. If you're a smaller state, it is important. So there were, as I say, very sound economic reasons for doing so. Prior to that point, we were looking at fairly significantly high interest rates. And we looked at ourselves and said, wouldn't it be great if we had German interest rates? And this was part of what we looked at as we evaluated what it would mean for us to join the eurozone. But as I wouldn't underestimate the political importance as well at the same time, that was important to us as well.
According to a recent Time magazine statistic, it said that 44% of EU citizens are dissatisfied of being in the European Union and their quality of life has gone down. Assuming this is true, why do you think that is, and what do you think could be done to solve this?
That has not been the experience in my country. I would say that in my country, there are not many things we do agree now among ourselves, but one of the things we do agree is that the European Union has been very positive, and I would say personally that it has been the most important decision we took in the last 100 years, and I don't think I don't know where this figure 44 could come. It's not what I've been reading in the last few years. So I really cannot answer for all the countries, but it definitely is not the case in my country.
I mentioned before the problem of communication, and I think for a too long period, the European construction was done without the cooperation of citizens, you know. And I think there is a necessity to involve, to engage more our citizens in the construction of Europe. And I think that the president of the Commission, Barroso, talks about, or he's speaking about a Europe of results, you know. And I think this is a very interesting notion. We need more a Europe of results. I'm speaking about the project, the European projects that we can launch, concrete, tangible, showing concrete results to the citizen. There is a need for a better communication between the institutions and the European citizens. And I think in the future it will be part of the policies that we want to support.
A very important point. I think in Europe and in the United States we share one big problem. We are all exposed to globalization. Globalization is a process which we cannot avoid. Globalization is a challenge which we all have to tackle. And that's the issue in Europe as well. So Europe is our response to globalization, because the dimension of the problem and the dimension of the challenges of the future sets apart all what we had before. So That's, in fact, maybe an issue of communication. We have to explain to our citizens that we may have in future years to tighten our belts, but not because we are member of the European Union, but because we are member of a globalized world economy. We have to compete and we have to become competitive. And that's, I think, a very important point to communicate to our citizen.
I think that we have to be always careful with statistics because, for example, the Eurobarometer, which is a statistical review that is done by the European Union yearly, shows, for example, for three questions, contradictory numbers. For example, it says this number about general how you are satisfied with the European Union. There is a number of 47%. Do you support the membership? Is 54%. Do you think that your country has benefited from the European Union? 58%. So it depends sometimes how a question is asked. So I think we should be a little bit careful with numbers.
I want to thank all the members of the panel. It was an interesting, exciting discussion. And thank you all for coming.
You've been listening to a panel discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences titled The European Union, United in Diversity. Speaking on the panel were Manuel Bairros, Consul General of Portugal, David Barry, Consul General of Ireland, François Gatier, Consul General of France, Konstantinos Orfanidis, Consul General of Greece, John Rankin, Consul General of the United Kingdom, Carlos Robles, Consul General of Spain, Wolfgang Vorwerk, Consul General of Germany, and Liboria Stellino, Consul General of Italy. Tonight's moderator was Alan Berger, Senior Editorial Page Editor for the Boston Globe. We began with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog with help from Matt Odette and Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.